Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 5th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Before we get started tonight, I have one administrative item to take care of. So, Anais, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Albert Bates is on a Mexican phone, and apparently the conference can't recognize the pound sign. So I'm going to ask you if you could flash him in through you, and I just emailed you his telephone number.
All right.
Okay, great. It's always something. Okay, so this evening we're going to review the top stories in Money and Markets at the blog, and then address two of the many great questions that we've gotten from you. A lot of the questions are in precious metals, and next week we're going to have Precious Metals Update with Franklin. So if you had a precious metals question, don't be concerned. We're going to go through all of them next week. Then we have Albert Bates, who's an incredible permaculturalist, a man of many talents, for the movers and shakers part. We're going to be talking about transition towns and financial permaculture. And then finally, some brief comments on the wonderful documentary, The Take, about the financial meltdown in Argentina. So let's start with Money and Markets. My, you know, Bill King and the King Report always says, you just couldn't make this stuff up. This week was so packed with incredible information. We're going through a very profound change, and it's accelerating. I keep thinking of William Butler Yeats had a line in a poem that I loved about the world right before World War II. He said, the things fall apart, the center cannot hold. And if you look at all the headlines this week on the blog, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing incredible signs of the sort of centralized systems breaking down and falling apart in very deep ways. So let me just run through a couple of the stories that are up on the blog and connect the dots between them. One is California is now indicating to both suppliers and people do tax refunds that it's going to send them IOUs and not dollars. So we have a community currency, as you know, if you might even want to call it, forming in California. One county has now said that they are stopping all payments to the state because the state is in effect not paying them dollars, so they won't pay the state. Now, if you look at the cash flows in this country, the intergovernmental payments between counties and municipalities and states and the federal government are very significant and very significant to keeping the economy going. And if we should see municipalities take the position that they're not going to send cash flows to the state or the federal government or vice versa, then you're talking about some very deep and profound change. So it's important to keep an eye on what happens in California. California's state budget is over $40 billion, so it's very significant. A second thing, we put a video up on the website of Congressman Kaptur from Ohio literally advising her constituencies who get foreclosed on to just squat in the house and not give the house up. Now, it's pretty profound to see a congresswoman saying, look, you know, the banks are over the line and you just need to take the property back, essentially by refusing to leave. So it's a sort of an escalation of where we are in sort of the state of lawlessness in Washington. Another story that you'll see more about, we've now seen legislation entered in Colorado, as we have in Indiana and Vermont, proposing that the state set up payment mechanisms in digital gold, literally proposing to create an alternative payment mechanism if the dollar should not be dependable. So it's quite extraordinary. And the most extraordinary is, in fact, a piece of legislation that was introduced in New Hampshire very recently. They just had hearings on it, which proposes that if the federal government is in violation of the constitutions in a variety of ways, New Hampshire asserting that they don't need to comply with any of these violations and basically claiming a very significant states' rights in accordance with the Constitution. So it's a real shot over the bow, and so that's something to watch. Another thing, very critical, I have a post on this up on the blog, is Kentucky. We have reports of anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000 people who have gone without electricity for over a week, and reports that it may take as long as 4 to 6 weeks to get a significant number of people back on power. And the posts that we're seeing come from Kentucky indicate that the people there sort of feel like they're on their own. It's not unlike Katrina. The federal government is busy sort of lobbying to bail out the banks, and there's no federal help or support for Kentucky. And you really get, again, this feeling of we're on our own. And so so whether it's Colorado, Indiana, California, Ohio, Kentucky, New Hampshire, all over the country, what you're seeing is this sense of we can't look to the federal government. We're going to have to move forward. And that's one of the reasons I wanted Albert Bates to join us today, because he's part of a group of people who've just been, you know, sort of figuring they were on their own and moving forward for an awful long time. In response to a lot of the news, I posted a series of articles that I wrote this weekend, one called Financial Coup d'Etat, and then the second called Rethinking Diversification. And really what I wanted to point out was what a lot of us have thought of as diversification is really diversification within this dependency on a centralized system. So, for example, diversification is picking different industries within your brokerage account, but having everything in one brokerage account. And what the events of sort of the systems breaking down, whether it's the energy system in Kentucky or the financial system coming out of New York, you know, the message again and again is it's dangerous to depend on centralized systems, and simply diversifying within centralized systems is not enough. We really need to go back to a much deeper, older, more traditional kind of decentralization. Somebody reposted the article and said, and changed the name to decentralizing everything, or diversifying everything. So it's really important to me that everyone in the Solari network really take the time now to think about, okay, what would I do? How would I respond to a Kentucky event or a Katrina event or a Madoff event happening in my portfolio? I mean, we're watching all the different kinds of breakdowns that happen when centralized systems aren't reliable, and it can hit in every aspect in our life. And so what can we do to understand what that would feel like? One of the messages that's going to come across when we talk to Albert is that the sooner you start thinking about this and the more prepared you are to act, the faster you are to take action as opposed to wait for someone else to come along and help, the faster you move to action, the better off you are in most of these circumstances. Now, what we're seeing, and this is, again, part of what's in the news, is we still have a very significant, almost addiction to watching what is happening in Washington. And if you look at the kind of breakdown that's happening economically around the country, what you're seeing is the very natural thing that happens when it's economic to be decentralized. So we've centralized in a very uneconomic way. We've used massive amounts of government debt to pull it off and to get the economics to work when, in fact, they really don't. The fundamental economics say we should be decentralizing. And literally the collapse that we're watching is part of the move to just to naturally decentralize. Macy's announced 7,000 layoffs last week or earlier this week, and it was last week, and 4%, that's 4% of their workforce. But one of the things they announced with it is they are turning over much more autonomy to each store, so much less central control. And part of the layoffs was 40% of their sort of centralized corporate staff, because they're switching the management down to decentralized levels. It's sort of decentralize, you know, or die. And so we're going to be seeing that, those kind of economics throughout the economy. Unfortunately, everybody's looking to Washington in the hopes that some kind of big stimulus package is going to help. It's not. If you look at what's going on in the economy in 3,100 counties and what's in the stimulus package, I'm not saying that it won't help, but there's no significant vision that will change sort of a negative return on investment in 3,100 counties into a positive. If anything, it's going to centralize even more. So if you look at how much of our time we're spending sort of watching what's going on in New York and Washington versus watching what's going on around us and investing and taking action, part of what needs to switch as a culture is we need to sort of stop watching the pro-centralization team and get about the business of protecting ourselves in a very decentralized and out-of-control world. So that's it for Money and Markets. There's a tremendous number of posts going up on the blog. One of the most recent, I just want to point out to you, we're not going to talk about it this week, but I think it's probably the most significant piece of the stimulus package in terms of its potential to change and affect our lives, and that's the medical database. The administration is proposing a database for all Americans, all health information. There's indications that the plans are it's mandatory. And I think the most important thing on this for me is to just get the facts. So what I put up on the blog today is just the facts of the medical database, and I'm going to be posting more and talking about it, but I just give you a heads up that in addition to the stories we've discussed, it's there, and I encourage you to really read the financial coup d'etat and the diversification piece, because they really get into a conceptual framework of what each one of us need to think about and do in our own lives and own families. Okay, so that's it for Money and Markets. We had some great questions in Ask Catherine. One of them was, and I could talk about both of these questions for about an hour each, so we're just going to go quickly. One was, where does the value go when a market drop? The media uses phrases like X billions were vaporized. Is it that somebody won all that value, zero-sum game, or did it actually go someplace? Really, what this question gets to the heart of is, if the market drops, is somebody making as much money as somebody losing? And I want to talk about this. I want to try and just give you a simple overview of this, because it's very, very important to understand that more money is potentially made in a drop, or let's call it a pump and dump, when the market runs up a lot and there's a pump, because you have people pumping it up. Certainly what we're experiencing right now is the dump in a pump and dump. More money is made on the dump than on the pump. And think of it this way. We've learned to price our assets in paper money, dollars. But in fact, if you look at real wealth, it comes from real things. So it comes from acres of land with great topsoil, or it comes from the harvest, or it comes from intelligence that builds software. So it comes from real things. If you look in the stimulus package, there's a tremendous amount going on now about developing, redeveloping, and investing in water infrastructure throughout the country, because water is increasingly a very important asset. So if you look at the market, if you look at the stock market as really simply interests in real things, the name of the game in making money or in the economy is strategic control of real things. So in fact, one of the reasons that a dump is so profitable for so many people is it gives them the opportunity if they have inside information, which often happens, to get much greater control of real assets at very, very cheap prices. So, for example, let's say the stock market drops 50%. That doesn't mean that that money went to someone else, although it could. If people know ahead of time and are shorting the market, they absolutely can make money. In fact, you know, in a pump and dump fraud, you make money going up and you make money going down, and then you take those profits to buy control of real assets when the prices are way down, which is why you make more money on the dump than you make on the pump. So in no way am I saying it's tit for tat, that if the market goes down 50%, that other people got that 50%. But in fact, what's really important to understand is, let's say the market represents, you know, I'm grossly oversimplified, a markets in our fictional world represents 1,000 acres, 1,000 head of cattle, and 100 factories. When the market drops 50%, it still represents the same things. And so the real value didn't change. It was simply the paper bubble that changed. And one of the things we're going to be talking about with Albert is the extent to which we tried to keep the party going, not by getting our real things to do, you know, to do more with less, but just by printing a bunch of paper and not, you know, getting snookered by that inflationary bubble. So when a market drops, don't assume that the money didn't just vaporize, because in fact the real game is not on the paper, the real game is on the real things. And in fact, anybody who has the inside information to toggle back and forth between paper assets and real things, or using cash or liquidity in the middle, you know, it's the up and down that benefit them and give them the ability to sort of parasite the economy. Bank holiday. The second question was, what are the chances of banks being nationalized by the new administration? What are the warning signs that this is imminent, and what steps do you suggest to protect deposits from business bank accounts which are going to have more than $250,000 guaranteed by the FDIC? I can't put my business funds into treasuries or gold. I need the liquidity to meet payroll and to function. Great question, because it's a problem many people are having right now. We're seeing there's certain kinds of special accounts that have been set up that will let you, that will automatically parse the money at different FDIC accounts, FDIC guaranteed accounts, and so you can usually take it up to about $1 million of FDIC, or obviously you can do business with a variety of different banks and get your benefit. My guess is if they nationalize the banks, the goal of nationalization will be to use the strong banks, which are thousands of banks across the country that didn't do derivatives and all the crazy stuff, use those banks to subsidize the unhealthy banks. So we're going to take all the banks that did all the fraud, and we're going to dig them out of their fraud by basically, in essence, through nationalization, merging them with the little guys, and basically ripping off their equity, so to speak. You know, it's very possible that they could do a partial nationalization. So the other thing they do is they just nationalize the banks that are hurting and then, you know, pump money in the way they've been pumping. But the reality is, if you look at how much money they're putting into all these bailouts, these are not bailouts. That's the spin. What we're watching is a coup d'etat. And one of the posts that I've got up on the blog is that $8.5 billion that has gone so far into the bailouts from Treasury and the Federal Reserve is more than all the wars we've ever fought, plus the space program, plus the Marshall Plan, plus you know, some of the other big programs. So the magnitude of the money is enormous. Okay, so if you can't spread it around between different banks, what do you do? What I would suggest that your danger is not going to come, or our business risk, because I'm in the same position. Our business risk is not going to come from a nationalization. I think a nationalization will be engineered to sort of protect liquidity on these items. I think our real danger is going to come if for any reason the FDIC credit should be weak, And that weakness will be, the way we'll know it is if the Treasury has a hard time rolling over. The Treasury just announced a huge, big schedule of debt this week. I think it's $67 billion they're financing next week. If we start to see real problems with the Fed being able to just print and get people to hold dollars, we start to see the dollar fall and real problems with the dollars in the foreign markets that indicates that we're headed into hyperinflation, that's when the FDIC credit may not be worth so much, and that's when we have to come up with some other alternatives, and that's when we are going to have to go into things like community currencies and arrangements, or gold may not look so bad. I mean, in my Solari circle, we use gold to park our gold to park our cash in, so we use it for short-term liquidity, and that's worked very well for us. But you have to live with the volatility, and it's very difficult to meet a payroll that way. So I understand. But I would focus not so much about nationalization, but about the FDIC credit not holding. And if you look at the deeper news this week and the possibilities of what could happen coming into the tax dates and the disclosure dates in March and April, I think, you know, there is a possibility of that scenario this year. Next week we're going to be talking with Franklin Sanders, and he feels it's unlikely this year. It's much more 2010-2011. But I think it's something we need, if you're a business person, if you're responsible for a household, we need to start planning and thinking about it this for this year. Okay, Albert Bates. Albert, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, now, are you coming in by the, did Anais, did you flash Albert in?
Yeah, I'm in on the telephone. Can you hear me okay?
Okay, so you're going to have to talk really loud, Albert.
Okay, I'll try and do that.
Okay, so let me introduce you. Albert is many things. He's a lawyer. He's an author. He's a teacher. He's an inventor with several patents to his name. Albert, you're so many things I don't even know what to say. He's my neighbor.
If they ever ask me to speak at a commencement, my advice would be retire early, retire often.
Albert is also my neighbor in Tennessee, about 2 hours away, because he's one of the founders of The Farm, which is an intentional community in Lewis County. It's in Summertown, Tennessee, and it's Lewis County is Hohenwald, which is the home of financial permaculture, and Albert is one of the inventors of financial permaculture. So, Albert, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you've had the privilege of going out onto the land and trying to invent a sustainable community from scratch. And you did it starting in 1970, so you have many, many years of experience at doing this, and we're all just beginning to contemplate how we're gonna change our lifestyle. So what was it like in the 70s?
Well, we went through an interesting cycle of boom and bust in our own way. We actually sort of proved out the Peter principle and elevated people to the point of their own incompetence, and we kept growing without any reasonable restriction on limits, and got to a point where we were pretty incompetent at the levels that we were trying to manage as basically anarchistic hippies. We didn't have much truck with bureaucratic systems. Well, it turns out you need a fair amount of good accounting and good legal structure and contracts and things like that if you're going to run a multi-million-dollar enterprise. And when we got up to around, you know, over 1,000 people, we found that we were running several millions of dollars, and we really needed to be much more professional about it. So we actually went through a rather painful contraction in the early 1980s, where we shed a lot of our illusions and slimmed it down to something that was more manageable for us. And we got to the scale where we are today of a couple hundred people running about the same level of finance that we were running as 1,000 people, but doing it much more efficiently.
And you have several successful businesses on the farm and a whole bunch of not-for-profits.
Yes, and those were built over the rubble of many failures.
Right.
We were initially thinking we would do everything around agriculture, that we would have a large farming operation and that we would produce organic food and sell it into the national market. And we fairly soon learned that with farm prices what they were and the nature of parity, that it was unlikely we were going to be able to capitalize building an entire community and all the houses and roads and water systems and infrastructure just on proceeds from farming.
Right.
So we got into a few other cottage industries, and we did a lot of hitting and missing of successful and unsuccessful ones. The successful ones endured and are with us today, and that includes our book publishing company that puts out 30 or 40 new titles a year, and our electronics company that does several $1 million a year in various different high-end electronic devices. And we have some boutique-y sorts of businesses as well that are small sort of mom-and-pop operations but do quite well.
One of the things, because our fulfillment is over in the mail order catalog at the farm. One of the things that really attracted me to getting to know the people at the farm and getting to know you and your work at the Echo Village Training Center was you have a very unique combination of just sort of real-world experiences, entrepreneurs making things work on a wide variety of different kinds of enterprises, whether it's teaching or business or whatever, and you really, so you're very, very grounded and have tremendous practical experience, and so it's not surprising to me that we all came together with the local community around financial permaculture.
Right. Well, we've been trying, actually, to reach out to our surrounding community in recent years because, you know, you're not an island, and we can try and have our green economy within the confines of the borders of the farm, but ultimately we do have the surrounding county and the surrounding state and the surrounding country to be concerned about, because what happens to them also affects us, and if they are insecure, then ultimately we are insecure. So it starts by reaching out and finding points of alignment. Where can we actually find agreement? And can we help by passing along some of the things that we've learned, many of them the hard way, to our neighbors in Lewis County? So designing a financial permaculture course was one element of that. We actually did a number of things like enrichment nights where we would show movies at the local college, and we would have invited speakers in to talk, and we did a village design course early last year. So we've been trying over the course of the last few years to expand our interactions to try to create a more neighbor-to-neighbor exchange of information.
Well, one of the things I wanted you to do tonight is introduce us to what is a global eco village, or what is an eco village, and what is a transition town, and how can people who haven't been part of these things learn about them and hook into them, because they have, you know, it's funny, a lot of the people in the Solari Network are now grappling with how do I become more self-sufficient. Of course, the first thing you figure out when you try and become more self-sufficient is it's a lot easier to not do it by yourself. So tell us about Echo Villages and then first, and then we'll go to transition towns after that.
Well, there's actually very little that you can do just by yourself. We all stand on the shoulders of others, whether it's our parents, our teachers, our employers, and so forth. We all work with a group of people around us who are our social support network. And there was a period back in the 80s, mostly, when a lot of us who were involved in intentional communities and experimental settings in rural areas began to think more in terms of this concept of eco-village. And we had a meeting in Denmark in the 1990s where we drew together people who had been experimenting in various different countries with this idea of an eco-village. And what we found was that we really had a much broader movement than we had thought we did, and that there was a lot of interest was picking up in this, and that we should form a network to try to formalize the relationships and be able to communicate more effectively. And so we created the Global Ecovillage Network and had a conference, an international conference in Scotland in 1995, the first international conference on ecovillages and sustainable communities. And from that, we developed a very large, well-funded organization that now has consultative status at the United Nations and attends conferences on sustainable development, and also is involved in the Habitat conferences of the UN to try to re-engineer the way human society relates to the built environment in ways that are more benign ecologically, but are also healthier socially and spiritually. You know, it's not, we talk about it in terms of the three-legged stool, that it's not just ecology, that there's a whole checklist in the social side and the spiritual side. If your community isn't doing all of those, then it's wobbly. And you really need to have good transparency in your governance. You need to have involvement of all the different people and all their different interests. You need to have ways to voice those interests. So that got us into this idea of having tools for building eco-villages and developing courses. And from that, we created the Eco-Village Training Center in Tennessee as a prototype. And I'm happy to say that after 10 or 15 years now, we probably have a dozen or more very strong second efforts in that regard, where we have in different countries of the world Eco-Village Training Centers. Many of them are much better than the original one at the farm. And that's good. I mean, that means that we're succeeding, and the model is taking off. And we've seen
eco-villages. One of the things that has really struck me when in all of my dealings with the Eco-Village Training Center is you're attracting a quality of young person who's coming, you know, through the different courses and activities that is of the quality I used to see on Wall Street. And these are fabulous young kids who are saying, "Hey, we don't want to be part of the centralized stuff. We're going to build a new world." So the talent that's been coming through is incredible.
Well, that's also a piece of it, is as you get to these standards of what does it mean to really be a sustainable community, you get into this new holographic circulatory worldview where you begin to understand that everything really is connected to everything else. And if we're going to have peace, if we're going to have prosperity, if we're going to create community resilience, we really need to think in terms of changing the global consciousness, that we need to think of ourselves as a whole, and it's a we, not an I kind of world. And how do you get people to come to that? You know, and so that actually gets me to the next point, which is that we've evolved now to understand that it's not just about these experimental communities. Those are nice little seeds out there where we're sort of in isolation creating these memes that will then be propagated out through the culture. But at the same time, how do you actually transition existing towns and cities to become more ecologically and socially and spiritually sustainable? And one would have to say that that's a much more tricky proposition, because there's a lot of inertia, there's a lot of culture already pre-existing. And it's not that you're coming in with a specific shared intention or shared vision. It's that you're taking the existing intentions, the existing vision, and morphing those into a whole that's much more holographic and circulatory worldview. So,
right, but my impression is the transition town is spreading rapidly.
Yeah.
I mean, people are really, I think, a lot more people. I mean, if you look at Lewis County, the real leader in the Financial Permaculture Conference was the Chamber of Commerce. And so you have the leaders of the Chamber of Commerce saying, "Hey, there's a real problem. We're on our own. We've got to do something." And that's new, I think.
That's true. And in fact, a lot of people are sort of coming to this realization, sometimes being dragged kicking and screaming into it. And Rob Hopkins was this teacher of permaculture, and he was working at a school in Ireland, in Kinsale, in Ireland, and he decided he was going to do an energy audit of his town. And as he did that, the more he did it, the more he realized that the town really was dependent on outside sources for virtually everything it had, and that it was not very resilient to any kinds of catastrophes that might strike the economy in the larger parts of Western Ireland. And that, you know, if they were really going to be more resilient and more self-contained and actually cycle the economy locally, they needed to come up with an energy descent plan where they became much more thoughtful about how they get their food, how they handle their water and their waste, what do they do with the incubation of small businesses and so forth. And so as he got more into that, the more he thought about it, and he went back to his original home in Totnes, England, and he came up with this idea of a 12-step program for towns, like ending your addictions. And the 12-step program essentially was, you know, set up a steering group and design its demise from the outset. You know, put your core team on notice that once everything's going, they have to let they have to step back and let the town function as if it was their idea. And then awareness raising is the second stage. You know, identify your key allies and build your crucial networks. And then the third stage is laying the foundation, making clear to all the different stakeholders what's involved and acknowledge and honor the work of everybody for what they do. And then the fourth step is organizing a great unleashing, which is the official recognition by the town that they want to transition into something much more sustainable and much more economically resilient. And then forming subgroups and creating plans for transition, using open space technology to effectively run meetings that are very open and transparent and accessible, developing viable practical manifestations of the project so you actually have things that you can look at and see, and then facilitate a reskilling, you know, a retraining. This is kind of what the Ecovillage Training Center is all about, is the idea of having workshops and courses on how you do cooking and repairing and natural building and gardening and herb walks and home energy efficiency and how to bake bread and things like that. And then a ninth step of the transition movement is to build a bridge to local government. And that's what you're talking about, the idea that the council or the Chamber of Commerce has a stake, the community council, the county council has a stake. So let's bring them in. Let's talk about what are their responsibilities and how can we help. And then honoring the elders, you know, those of us born a lot earlier and been through all this. Many of us remember the Great Depression or some of the things of World War II, the rationing and so forth. And what can we learn from that? And then the 11th step is to let it go where it wants to go. You know, this idea of stepping back. You've got a clear idea now, but then follow what new ideas pop up, because some of them can be absolutely brilliant. Don't be rigid in what might come. And then the last step is to create this energy transition plan for how you're going to deal with climate change and energy and food and water and the various different needs that your community has, and plans, you know, with serious timelines. You know, look out 15 years, look out 20 years, and see what is it going to be like for your children when they reach the age where they need employment, and what's going to keep them there? What are the values that are going to keep them there? And then work on those, you know, to significantly put resilience first and to drastically reduce your carbon emissions and to create a vital economy. But, you know, we're all basically coming from the standpoint of if we wait for the governments, it's going to be too little and too late.
Well, one of the things that was funny in the Hohenwald situation was we, on the steering committee, we agreed that we didn't agree on peak oil and climate change, but we did all agree that it was urgent that we decentralize.
Yeah.
And so we skipped right over that. And
that's
it was
great.
Funny because our map of the world was different, but what was similar was, you know, we agreed that we needed to take action and we needed to take the same kind of actions.
Right. Well, and you know, developing environmental initiatives is always hard. And people are, you know, they got other things that they're more important. You know, they got to get to work the next day. They got to get the kids off to school. But you know, the transition towns is actually more like a slide. It's the car starts to move faster, and you don't have to accelerate anymore. It's like on the top of a hill, and it's continuing its own momentum. So. Now it's actually become viral, and we see the transition towns spreading outward from this 12-step model that began in Totnes, England, to where today there are officially the ones that are initiatives that are sanctioned by the transition network. There are 134 towns and cities that are officially recognized. There are another 600 or more that are mulling the idea, or at some stage, like Hohenwald's in this category, of just getting to the stage now of passing a city resolution where they can become officially sanctioned. But the mullers in North America include, you know, a lot of small and medium-sized towns, Santa Rosa, Traverse City, Boulder, Putney, Vermont, Asheville, North Carolina, and Ketchum, Maine. But the list also includes some very ambitious cities, you know, big cities.
Right.
Vancouver, Montreal, Tulsa, Austin, New York City, Oakland, Philadelphia, Denver, Anchorage.
So, well, I was amazed to watch how the transition town idea resonated with all sorts of different constituencies in Hohenwald. And it really became electric, and it was a very organic, natural kind of process. And, you know, it really resonated. So it wouldn't surprise me to see a real significant growth in this sort of dynamic.
Yeah, I think it's actually reaching the point now where it's starting to break through to some important parts of the community. You know, you have to draw in some very conservative government and business leaders who really don't relish the idea of changing the status quo ante. Things are going fine. They've learned how to structure their lives around an anticipated result for an anticipated for an action that they know. So now, you know, one of the great things about a sudden change, whether it's good or bad, is that it loosens that up and makes new things possible. And I think you're starting to see that in Hohenwald.
One of the other things that really helped build tremendous alignment was a definition was created of green. The definition of green was no waste. And the editor of the newspaper gave a fabulous speech about old-timey values in Tennessee and how, in fact, you know, old-timey was green and, you know, Tennessee had been green for years, you know, for decades, if not centuries, and really brought, you know, everybody could connect to the definition. And waste could be anything you've cared about. It could be spiritual, it could be emotional, it could be, you know, so it could be human waste as well as natural resources or money. So it was a very inclusive definition. And, you know, and it had, I think it had a lot to do with bringing us together.
Yeah, people who learned from the last depression really have that ethic that, of being frugal and not wasting anything.
Right.
You know, you send your child off to school with a paper bag full of a sandwich, and they bring back the wax paper and the paper bag so it can be used again the next day.
Uh-huh.
You know, that kind of thing. And that's not that far back in our history that we've lost memory of it, because we still have people around who remember that.
One of the reasons I always find talking with you so fascinating is you travel and live all over the world. I mean, you really have a global, you know, you're teaching and living and working all over the world. And we've talked about how some of the global village, the eco villages and the transition towns have dealt with sort of the economic changes upon us, particularly in places who've gotten hit before we have. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about Iceland and Los Angeles and some of the other great examples.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Iceland is a really good example because it's kind of a poster child for collapse of the banking Ponzi scheme, you know. And they're at 16% unemployment with 25% projected for later this year. And the Icelandic kroner is virtually worthless now against the euro. Their fishing fleet, which was their biggest industry, really is bankrupt, and the government's disgraced, and it's turned out of office by angry mobs in the street who are, you know, making bonfires outside of Parliament. But Iceland is also the home to this exemplary eco-village, and it's one of the best examples that we have in the entire global eco-village network. It's called Solheimr, means the place of the sun in Icelandic, and about one-third of the county that around them, the Grimness County in Iceland, actually are inhabitants of Solheimr. And at least five businesses and four workshops are operated there, manufacturing workshops. And they're very good at growing organic food. They were the first organic producers in Nordic countries. You know, it's funny, I ask people sometimes, this is sort of a pop quiz, do they know who the largest exporter of bananas in the European Union is? And most people think it's Spain or Greece or someplace, but actually it's Iceland.
Wow.
The way they get the bananas is in greenhouses that are heated by geothermal. And this woman, Cecilia Sigmund's daughter, back in 1930, moved out to the countryside and bought a farm that had a hot spring on it. It produced 200 gallons a minute of boiling water. And with that, she was able to build these greenhouses to make food. And she created a service center and a day nursery for the physically handicapped and then for the developmentally challenged children. So she was not only a pioneer in the field of organic food and in geothermally produced bananas, but she was also a pioneer in the care of the developmentally challenged outside of institutions. They predated the Camp Hill movement in providing this homesteading care for people who were challenged. And
you got to talk up, Albert.
Okay, so Jeff's now 79 years old. And Solheimr's businesses are booming, and they're a model for the rest of Iceland. And actually what's happening now is that as people have lost work, people are providing the health care and the food and the gainful employment of their surrounding area, which is an example to the rest of the world. Ireland has another good example, which is the village, which is in County Kildare, or County Killarney. And it was actually... Ireland is going through something similar to Iceland right now, another banking bubble. And what the village has done is it's reached out to the surrounding town, which is Clogjordan, and it's begun the Transition Towns movement. It was actually chosen, the location, because of the rail line and the good farmland and the water and the economics and the charm. And so now Clogjordan is mulling transition town status, and it's got this eco-village right in the center of it to have to draw creative young Dubliners out to the countryside. And then the other example you mentioned was Los Angeles. Los Angeles eco-village was started back in 1993, and this was just one woman, Lois Arkin, who decided, how can I get my neighbors involved in living more ecologically? And so she started these processes of having talks and workshops and dinners and things. And she's right there in the middle of downtown Los Angeles, one block east of Los Angeles' most busy auto corridor, Vermont Avenue. And she's been able to draw in about, there's 500 persons live in this historically significant area. And she's got the ability to draw in about 48 different apartment dwellers into what they call the Los Angeles Eco-Village now. And they've actually bought buildings, and people are moving there to that neighborhood. And they call their members just neighbors. And they draw in the neighbors, and they have potlucks, and they have community meetings and workshops on permaculture and sustainable urban living and work parties. And about half of the people there no longer own cars. They're actually starting a small ecological cooperative neighborhood business, and one of the businesses is bicycle repair. Households that don't own cars now receive a $20 a month discount on their rent in Los Angeles Eco Village. So they're encouraging people to get away from cars and more into a walkable city. And they've gotten the city to re-sculpt their street and to do traffic calming, and also to open up the waterways that had been covered over. The Bimini Slough was the old waterway there, and it had been paved over, and they've gotten the city now to open that up. So, this is the kind of thing you can do if you get organized and don't be deterred by large government institutions.
I was not able to get, or I haven't been able to get anybody interested in transition towns here because in Lewis County, it's much more a let's develop the people and make sure that, it's a people-centric and a living thing-centric model. whereas I'm in a county where it's much more real estate fee-driven and construction is the development model. But what we did was a local farmer here brought together a group of people with very widely varied skills. We have a nurse practitioner and a machinist and farmers and a home builder and a gunsmith and just, you know, just tremendous wealth of concrete skills. And we just come together once a month for dinner and try and teach each other. I told you, because I know you're a ham radio. You're an amateur radio. You've got your license. And, you know, they've even got me getting my license, my ham radio license. So, you know, but over, we've done it now for a couple of years. And it's amazing with just one potluck dinner once a month, what a change in my life it's made. You know, they've really gotten me off the duff to learn a whole bunch of new things that I could never have learned if I had to do it by myself. It would have just been much too overwhelming. And, you know, it takes time, but we now are through the phase of discomfort and really look forward to seeing each other and working on the next thing.
Right, and that's actually, there's been a study done in British Columbia by a professor about communities, and particularly intentional communities, and how long they survive. And the index of success seems, the best index of success seems to be how often they eat together. if they share a meal every day, then they have a really high chance of success. If they come together once a week, they still do better than those who never eat together.
Wow. That is so fascinating, Albert. Well, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is how can I encourage everybody in my network? You know, there are two things we need to do. We need to pull our money out of sort of financing big corporations and back into financing the kind of networks of small business and communities that, one, will provide us with the strategic resources we need to be successful. You know, how are you going to get really great food if you don't provide for it yourself or help somebody who does? You know, but the other, before we can bring that money across, we really need to invent the train tracks. And I, you know, what I would love is for you to just say a little bit about what happened in Hohenwald last year and what's happening now. We're coming into a summit, and how that relates to the Echo Village Training Center.
Well, I mentioned that the Eco Village Training Center really had been concerned that, you know, we had been working very well with individuals coming to us really from all over the world. We were getting people coming from Latin America and from Africa and from Asia to take our courses. But we weren't very involved with the transformation that was happening locally and that really needed to happen. And so we decided to just allocate a huge chunk of our annual budget to doing that. And we consider that the work we did really is foundational. You know, we provided theoretical and practical underpinnings for the local relocalization of the economy of a rural county in Tennessee. But it's a model. And one of the things that came out of the financial permaculture course is we had lots of people come from other places. And they went back to those communities. And they're doing similar kinds of things. They're taking those lessons that they learned and trying to rebuild their own communities the same way. And we're also this year hosting the Continental Bioregional Congress in October, you know, just right after our next financial permaculture course. And practically all of these seminal movements, eco-villages, transitional towns, complementary currencies, they identify themselves as bioregionalists. But that movement itself is really kind of an orphan. It's underfunded, and it hasn't had the ability to have offices or newsletters or things. But the idea is that you have your local economy is dictated by what nature provides in your region. And your language and your culture are all very much a reflection of what your region is like. It has a particular place to it. And so we're going to be hosting the 10th Bioregional Congress. It was supposed to be 3 years ago, but they had no support to have it. So the farm just decided we're going to offer it because the Eco Village Training Center is going to sponsor that. And I have to say, it's not cheap to offer to host 500 people from all over the world for a week. You know, I have to raise $10,000 or $20,000 in the next 3 or 4 months just to build toilets and showers for campgrounds, not to mention office support. And
if somebody wants to help you do that, how can they contact you?
Well, you can go to the Eco Village Training Center website, you know, thefarm.org, or you can email me. You can probably put up a link from your website that we can tell people how to contact me.
Now, you're also teaching a permaculture course in March, which if I wasn't such a lover of luxury, I would take.
It's a very rustic setting, but all of the food is provided from within 500 feet of the actual site where we're teaching the course.
It's in Belize.
We're here for 2 weeks. And we're teaching the standard 72-hour curriculum in permaculture.
So you can get certified in permaculture. If somebody's interested, how do they sign up or contact you?
They can go to our website. And again, it's thefarm.org, thefarm, one word, .org.
And just go to the Eco Village Training Center.
Eco Village Training Center, and you can find the information on our pages there.
And if folks want to find your book or your blog, how do they do that?
Okay, the book and the blog are at thegreatchange.com, and there's more information there, and about the financial permaculture course too. It's all linked from there. They can, you know, presumably we're getting another people from another 100 communities again coming this year, and the book is also out now on Kindle as the Financial Collapse Survival Guide. It was the Post Petroleum Survival Guide and Cookbook. Recipes for Changing Times, but that was in 2006. Times have changed, and so now it's out in Kindle format, and it's been revised with new material to be the Financial Collapse Survival Guide, and that's now available through Amazon on Kindle Book. I have to say it's the only book that has an appendix of the complete Red Cross Emergency Medical Response Handbook. So if you're stuck in a hurricane or earthquake or a tornado or a plane crash in the Hudson, you've got everything you need in your purse or your SSA case to survive.
I just finished doing, we're required by law to have a disaster recovery plan, which I found to be an absolutely fascinating exercise, but I wish I'd known that because that would have come in very handy. Anyway, okay, well, Albert, thank you so much for taking the time, especially to figure out how to come in from Cancun. We really appreciate it. And now, the one thing I wanted to mention is the Financial Permaculture Summit is again this fall. You can find out about it at financialpermaculture.com. The DVD from our first summit last year is up on my blog at solari.com/blog. And Albert, if anybody wants to meet you, can they meet you there?
Oh, absolutely. I'll definitely be there, and I'll be in Tennessee. And after the workshop in Belize in March, I'll be back in Tennessee for our usual course season, teaching from then until the fall in October when we're doing the Bioregional Congress.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much. Have a great evening. Okay, I wanted to just spend a couple minutes on our Let's Go to the Movies, which is our first documentary. It's The Take, which is a film made in 2004 by a wife and husband team of Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. And it tells the story of a group of workers in Buenos Aires, Argentina, who took control of a closed auto plant where they had once worked. If you watch it, what you discover is that their back pay, the auto plant was in the bankruptcy courts, their back pay was approximately the value of the appraisal of the factory. And so basically their proposal to the courts was, rather than get the pay, we'll just take the factory. We'll swap our one payable for the asset. And in the documentary, you get, and it was one of the reasons I wanted so much for us to watch it together, you get a sense of what it feels like to be living in a country and to have assets and to have a bank account and to have a job and to think that you're financially secure, and then one day wake up, it was in December 2001, a great deal of money has been pulled out of the country overnight, and essentially the economy collapses, and suddenly the government freezes your bank accounts, and you don't have access to your bank accounts, and you basically you're wiped out. And we've seen this. The article that I wrote is posted on the blog Financial Coup d'Etat is really about that. is what happens to people in these kind of situations. And one of my goals this year on the Solari Report is to have a series of guests or movies or other things that helps us see what it was like for people in different areas all around the world who've been experiencing this, this kind of sort of economic collapse. It's almost as though we have rolling collapses all around the world. I wanted you to get a feel for that, but the other thing that I think is really useful about this documentary is you get the sense of how easy it is for people to be in a state of shock and to wait for the authorities to do something, or to wait for the government to be right, or the business elites to do right, or the court to do right. And what you see is the people who are the most successful in that environment are those who say, we're not waiting for anybody, we're capable, we're responsible, we're the leaders. I'll never forget one point in 1998 when I was trying to stop the housing bubble. What a foolish thing to do. And my attorney was kind of saying to me how, was kind of complaining about how criminally we were being treated. And I had to explain to him, look, we're the leaders. And he couldn't fathom what I was saying. He couldn't fathom how we could be the leaders. And what I was trying to tell him is, you know, this thing is out of control. No one wants to do. No one knows what to do. Nobody knows what's going on. We're just going to have to invent a new way. We're going to have to find a new pathway through this, because if we don't, we're all going to be toast. And the idea that we were the leaders was, can feel kind of absurd. But when you watch the take, what you realize is people just realized, hey, we're on our own, you know, let's be the leaders, let's go. And it's amazing over time what they accomplish. And the faster you can get out of that state of shock and into the state of, okay, let's just start taking action. I call it turtling. You know, just start making little steps. Do what you can. Just get going. And you get a great feel from the take. So I would encourage you to watch it. One of the people who made it, Naomi Klein, has a book, The Shock Doctrine, and some great articles called Disaster Capitalism. And I also recommend them. Great background and preparation for dealing with the shock of what we're watching, either in the world now or what's coming. And you, as you read about what Latin America has gone through, or some of these other societies have gone through, you start to look around and realize people like Albert Bates and the folks at the farm, you know, they've been taking action for years. They haven't been waiting for anybody. They're just off and running. And in fact, the people who've been doing it for a while now are the ones who are in the best position to handle these kinds of situations. So watch the take. I think it'll help. Okay, so that's it for our Solari Report this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We love doing this. The Solari team just loves doing this. You're always in our prayers. We have our public prayer on Thursdays during the afternoon. You can learn more about it on the blog. Next week, we have our Precious Metals Update. I'm going to be going over to West Point, Tennessee, to Franklin's farm. Franklin Sanders is the money changer, and we'll do our Precious Metals Update from there. So one of the things that's most important to me is get any questions you have on precious metals addressed. If you haven't posted any questions you might have for Franklin, go ahead and get them posted this week at the control panel. And then the following week, our movie next week is going to be Trading Places, one of my favorite, Aaron Rousseau's great, great movie, Trading Places, with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. And then the following week, we're going to have James Turk, the founder of Gold Money, and just one of the real leaders in the precious metals world. So James is going to be with us. And then the following week, we're going to have John Rubino, who wrote James. James has a wonderful book, Navigate How to Profit from a Falling Dollar, that he co-authored with John. John has a new book called Clean Money about green investment, which is really terrific. So he's going to be with us for the first week of March. So we have a great, great lineup, and I hope you join us then. Again, if you can't listen to us live, remember, you can always get the MP3. You can always download the MP3. We should have it posted about 24 hours after the live call. So until next week, again, please remember, don't worry about whether there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.